Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. 50 years ago, 2.5 million people gathered in Washington, D.C. to call for a national jobs program and an end to Jim Crow segregation in the South. The March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom was organized by African-American civil rights advocates, and it was attended by people from all different ethnic backgrounds, allies in the fight for racial equality and justice. So what did it mean to stand up for racial justice in 1963, and what does it mean today? How do you fit into the legacy of the dream, and what is the work left to do for all of us? What does the dream of racial equality mean for people of conscience today? How do we honor that vision, that struggle, and that unfinished agenda? And how do we even define racial justice now? Well, joining us for this conversation, Alicia Garza is the executive director of People Organized to Win Employment Rights, or POWER. It's a multiracial, intergenerational organization fighting poverty in San Francisco and beyond. And Alicia helped launch POWER's Bayview Hunters Point organizing project in 2005. Hi, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've also got in studio Claire Byard, who's a co-founder of the Catalyst Project. That's an anti-racist movement building center. And Claire's been working as a political and social justice organizer with Catalyst for the last 13 years. Hi, Claire.
Hi, thanks for having us, Holly.
And joining us by phone, Rinku
Earth
Sen.
Reservation.
Rinku Sen is the president and executive director of the Applied Research Center, a leading racial justice think tank. She's also the publisher of Colorlines.com, which is a daily news site. And in a recent article, Rinku wrote, "Racial justice is key to a compassionate, inclusive, dynamic society." Hi, Rinku.
Hi. Great to join you.
Thank you. Well, so I'm going to ask each of you kind of a lightning round question here. I know it's a big question, but I'm going to ask you to just give sort of brief thoughts on the question of what is the significance of this 50th anniversary of the March on Washington? What's the significance today, half a century later? I'm going to start with you, Alicia.
Sure. So one of the pieces that I think is really interesting is that not only is this the 50-year anniversary of the March on Washington, but it's also the 200th anniversary of the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. And one of the things that we feel is really important is to recognize that 200 years later, we're still struggling with many of the same issues that we were struggling with then. And that, in fact, slavery is not over in the United States, but it has certainly changed character and changed form. So one of the things that's important to us to recognize on this 50th anniversary is to really talk about what does justice and equality look like in the United States and what has been the development, right, of inequality and oppression in the United States. And how do we understand that in a way that allows us to bring various oppressed and disenfranchised communities together to fight for their own liberation.
And it was 150 years ago, the Emancipation Proclamation, right? Yeah. Okay, Claire, the significance of 50 years of since the March on Washington.
I think Alicia just cut to the heart of it. And the only thing that I would add to that is that, as you said, we're here both to be honoring the vision and struggle, which is very important to do, even as we're looking at the work that is still left. And I think it's very important to have moments like the March on Washington, which are able to visibilize the long-term, not only decades-long grassroots struggles, but centuries-long. And that those are also moments which, while they do lift up and give us a chance to engage with what is complicated and contradictory and the nuances, that there are also places for us to really reflect on what are the things that are working so we can continue to build on that.
Build on what's working. And Rinku, you were there this Saturday with many people celebrating the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Tell us what it was like and what the meaning for you is.
It was a great event on Saturday. There were really tens of thousands of people, certainly in the high tens of thousands, lots of kids, very multi-generational, very multiracial. To me, the 50th anniversary really gives us a chance to put our own stake in the ground on racial justice and on questions of fairness and equity. And it gave us a chance to elevate today's demands and today's struggles. And the things that I heard people talk about the most at the march when I asked them why they were there, what they thought was important, was were three things. They were voting rights, jobs, and an end to racial profiling. So I think we have as clear an agenda today for change as it's as clear an agenda today as the agenda that the marchers 50 years ago carried forth. And they were successful. We can be too.
Interesting. Okay, so that was one thing that I did want to ask, because to me it does feel like there are so many issues on the table: mass incarceration, disparities in public education, racial profiling, the treatment of undocumented immigrants. Obviously, you mentioned the voting rights revocation. But you feel like the message is absolutely clear. Do you all agree here? What do you think? What does racial justice mean today in 2013? Claire and Alicia are being very polite to each other. You go first. No, you.
Sure. I think that is a very helpful list as far as identifying where there is a lot of energy at front lines of struggle and where there is a lot of possibility for continuing to build unifying frameworks. And I think it's also helpful for us when we're talking about racial justice to really look at the entire system of racial oppression in the United States and to see that these are key battles and key front lines, but what we're talking about is actually uprooting this entire system of divide and rule, which is being used to continue to consolidate wealth and power in the hands of the 1% in this country and globally as well.
And similarly, I think what we're talking about when we say racial justice is we're also talking about a rehumanization of disenfranchised and oppressed people in this country. One of the things that's important to recognize, right, is that these struggles around mass incarceration, around voting rights, around jobs, around racial profiling, they're really about the quality of life. And it's really about not just a recognition of who people are, but it's also an acknowledgement and a demand that people are able to live freely, that people are able to live with dignity, with respect. And that is something that cuts across racial lines, but certainly it's something that unites many, many people. We, for example, at Power, we talk about Black Lives Matter. And we say that because, you know, when we say mass incarceration, end mass incarceration, or restore voting rights, really what we're talking about is restoring the quality of life of people who have been denied that in some cases for centuries, right? And we want to make sure that we're lifting up the key role that anti-Black racism plays in this system of oppression and inequality.
And do you two, Claire and Alicia, agree with Rinku, who said that the agenda is as clear today as it was in 1963? And I guess it wasn't that clear then. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But Rinku said voting rights, jobs, and an end to racial profiling. Is that the agenda?
Again, I think the agenda is a rehumanization of people who have been dehumanized through many different channels. So I would agree that that the agenda is as clear as it was then. And I would also say that we're facing many of the same challenges that we were facing then. The March on Washington was dubbed a march for jobs and freedom. And when we talk about freedom, right, we're encompassing a number of different things. And they're both material, they're cultural, they're spiritual, right? It's about people's right to live with dignity and respect.
Mm-hmm. If I could just get in.
Yeah, go ahead, Rinku.
Back in here. The agenda broadly is going to encompass lots of different issues. So voting rights, racial profiling, jobs were certainly key to the agenda of this particular moment on Saturday, the 50th anniversary march. But, you know, there are issues in education and environment and healthcare, and that is because race is a part of everything. Mm-hmm. Everything that we do, every institution that affects our lives, that shapes our society, race is a part of it. There is not one thing I can think of that doesn't have a racial dimension. Mm-hmm. And because we're a complicated society, you know, we have lots of different identities as women, as different people with different racial identities by age, by class, etc., then, you know, it's natural that there's going to be a lot of different kinds of campaigns about a lot of making change in lots of institutions. the thing that we have to keep in mind, I think, while we're working wherever we're working, is that justice is equity. Equity and justice are the same thing. And what that really means is that everybody gets what they need to live a constructive and dignified life along the lines that Alicia has talked about. And what justice isn't is it isn't colorblindness. So colorblindness is a false and corrupt concept because the job is not to refuse to see, but rather to be able to see and still do the right thing. See people's race, see their identities, see who they actually are, and still do the right thing individually and institutionally. And justice isn't diversity either. Diversity is important, but diversity is about variety, getting the people into the room. It does not speak to what folks are able to do, what kind of power they're able to exercise once they are in the room. So in whatever issue we're working on, if we want to carry forward the legacy of our ancestors on racial justice, we need to be pressing for equity and not for a false notion of post-racialness, and not merely for diversity.
Well, let's talk about that, just the idea, because you hear this, it was even in this Pew study recently where people polled across ethnic lines all said that there was a lot more progress to be made in terms of racial justice, racial equity. But a lot of the time you hear this framed as the ideal is a colorblind society, so-called colorblind society. And Rinka, you've just taken issue with that term. I'd like to delve into that just a little bit more deeply. Claire, Alicia, anything that you want to say about, you know, this idea that, that somehow that's the goal? Or that once you have a black president, that, you know, it's over?
Well, certainly.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, right. I mean, well, certainly we've seen that that's not true. And that's not just a read of history, but it's also a read of our present conditions. So I think in the 2008 election of President Obama, there was not conversation necessarily about race, but there was conversation about hope and change that folks took and did with what they wanted. And then folks were disappointed, right, for in almost 8 years later, by the lack of progress, in particular on a racial justice agenda, as if the fact that President Obama is a black president was going to shift this really deeply rooted system of racial oppression and racial inequity. I think that one of the things that we should be paying attention to as it relates to colorblindness or as it relates to a kind of post-racial society is that we're living in a time when everything and nothing is about race. And it's really important to get comfortable talking about who we are and what we live under. We need to be able to not just say, well, you know, people are struggling. We need to be able to say, hey, in San Francisco, black folks are less than 7% of the population, but we're 60% of the jail population. We need to be able to talk about the fact that San Francisco is losing black folks faster than any other major U.S. city outside of post-Katrina New Orleans. And then we need to be able to talk about what do we do about that. Right. And we can't do that being colorblind. And we can't do that saying, well, we've surpassed race, because clearly there are groups and sectors in society that are not progressing. Right. At a rate that perhaps other folks would hope that they are. So we definitely want to make sure that we're lifting up that there are concrete conditions that are different for different communities, and that that's an important source of strength. And unless we're actually talking about what are the differences, it's very difficult to see what are the commonalities.
And that is Alicia Garza. She's executive director of People Organized to Win Employment Rights or Power. We're also joined by Claire Byard, who's co-founder of the Catalyst Project. That's an anti-racist movement building center. Rinku Sen is president and executive director of the Applied Research Center, which is a leading racial justice think tank. And she's the publisher of colorlines.com. And I want to invite listeners to join this conversation about what is the agenda for racial justice today? What's your role in it, regardless of what your ethnic background is? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you're somebody who was around during the March on Washington, tell us what it meant for you then, and what that time was like And that fight was about ending institutionalized racism. What do you think are the parallel struggles today? And where do you see the front lines of the battle for racial justice? 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And Rinku, I want to continue along the lines of what Alicia was just talking about. One of the things that you write in a recent Color Lines article, The Need for Plain Speech, is Americans define racism as individual, overt, and intentional. But modern forms of racial discrimination are often unintentional, systemic, and hidden. So let's talk about that. Like, what we're even talking about when we talk about racial attitudes and racism?
Well, the reason that I like to distinguish between the explicit forms of racism, you know, where there's a noose hanging or there is someone actually says, for example, you know, I'm going to seat you in the back of the restaurant near the bathroom because you have brown skin and not white skin. You know, our civil rights laws have very clearly prohibited that kind of explicit bias. And it's been, you know, 50 years almost since the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And so, you know, there have been two generations for Americans to understand that that is not cool behavior, that it will get you sued, and that you shouldn't engage in it. But racism, like other forms of oppression and discrimination, it's highly adaptable. You know, it can morph with changing conditions. And one of the ways in which racial bias has morphed, or a new expression, set of expressions of it, is in what seems to be race-neutral rules and practices, race-neutral policies and practices that nevertheless have create terrible racial harm. And you don't need an intentional racist in order to get such rules passed quite often and established, and in order for those rules to produce terrible results by race. So one of the ways that the reason it's important to be explicit when we're talking about race and racial discrimination is because it's very easy for Americans to miss that there is a terrible racial impact if the only thing they're looking for is a terrible racial intention. So I'll just use a quick example from California. In the year 2000, there were a set of advocates in California who wanted to reduce class sizes. That was very important to do. And they knew that districts in which kids were really in overcrowded classrooms were largely urban, poor districts of color. But they didn't want to talk about that because they were afraid of drawing down a backlash with people saying, oh, if you have crafted a law against to reduce class sizes by mentioning the kids of color who need that done, then you don't care about the little white kids in California. That's not going to be okay. So to avoid that, they left out all racial analysis from their advocacy and from crafting the bill. And they ended up with an incentive program that worked this way. If a district reduced its class sizes a little bit, it could then go get money from the state to do further reduction. And of course, who was able to do that but the wealthier, suburban, whiter districts? So they, you know, get a trailer, put another class in it, they find $70,000 to pay a teacher, and they get the job done. They go get more money. And then there was this terrible unintended consequence where the most experienced teachers started leaving the urban districts, the overcrowded districts that they had been teaching in, to take these jobs in the suburbs where they could have a smaller class and get paid more money. So if we're not willing to be explicit in the ways that people have described on this show, then we're going to miss. We're going to think we're doing good things and end up making the problem, in fact, worse rather than better.
And
that's the danger.
And Claire started Catalyst to focus on what white social justice activists can do to examine their own race privilege and be better allies for these social justice causes. And I think I'm quoting you, Claire, that you said, if people with race privilege don't examine that invisible power that they have, they could wield it in the wrong way. So talk about that for us.
I don't know if it's a direct quote, but it's definitely what
it's something
we
you
on.
Might have said.
Yeah, I think that Ruth's example is an excellent one, and this comes back to the question that you raised earlier about colorblindness, which we see a lot in working with white people in majority white social justice groups and communities, where, as Howard Zinn put it, you can't be neutral on a moving train. And when we refuse to look at the reality, which is that this country is still structured by racism, then even well-intentioned white people who may feel like we, in our hearts, have a commitment to justice and equity, including to racial justice, but when we refuse to look at the reality of the world that we're living in, then it's so easy for us to be pulled into whether or not we believe that we're actively supporting racist policies, legislations, behaviors, cultural practices, that we still, if we're passive, become supporters. And that it's incredibly dangerous for us to take the idea that colorblindness is the ideal that we're moving towards, because that really... it closes doors for those of us who are white and who, part of being raised white in this country, is being taught to not understand what racism is, to not understand ways that we're experiencing racial privilege. And when we don't get what's going on around us, it's very hard for us to be effective and accountable participants in trying to change that and move towards real justice and equity.
And we're going to go to a break in just a couple of minutes, so we may dip into this question and not have the time to fully explore it. But one of the questions that I have is, how do you reach people who you want to bring into this coalition who might be, isolated by the terminology of oppressed and oppressor? How do you use language to reach the people that you're trying to reach so that you can have a broad coalition of allies, that this is not just about African Americans who are being racially profiled and it's their issue and you know, solve it alone? How do you bring more people into this and use language that is not going to isolate people? Alicia? Claire? Rinku?
Well, one of the things I think is important is we don't want to beat around the bush, but we also do want to bring everybody's experiences to the table. That's the way that we're going to really investigate and dismantle these things that we consciously and unconsciously lift up and advance. It is important for communities of color to be able to acknowledge racism, because racism is so unacknowledged most of the time. But in terms of bringing people together, right, we really want to share stories about how does racism impact you, which means that it's not so much just a question of oppressor and oppressed, right? We talk about how, for example, racism impacts white folks, right? And impacts white folks in a negative way. So it's not so much a polarized thing, but it's about understanding the ways in which each of us participate, but also have the ability to resist, right? And so we want to lift up the ways in which we can also fight back, right? Some of the small ways in terms of understanding each other's cultures, experiencing things that you haven't experienced before, listening to the experiences of someone that you may or may not come into contact with regularly, all the way up to taking public and demonstrative action against things that hurt our communities and for things that lift up and revitalize our communities.
And that is Alicia Garza. She's Executive Director of People Organized to Win Employment Rights here in San Francisco. We're also joined by Claire Byard, who's co-founder of the Catalyst Project. That's an anti-racist movement building center. And we're joined by phone by Rinku Sen, who's the President and Executive Director of the Applied Research Center, and she's also the publisher of Colorlines.com. Our conversation is about what is racial equality and what is the fight for racial justice 50 years after the March on Washington. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after a short break.
This is Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco, coming up at 11 o'clock in just 30 minutes. KALW will broadcast historic coverage from the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom as it was heard on the educational radio network on this day 50 years ago. You'll hear Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech in its original context, as well as other speakers on the official March program. Coverage of the March on Washington as it was heard 50 years ago, coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock here on local public radio.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, how concerned should we be about Fukushima? We know that radioactive water is seeping into the Pacific Ocean and into the water table surrounding the nuclear power plant that was damaged in the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. So what do we need to know about that, and what should we be doing about it? Friday is our media roundtable, where we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Today is the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech and the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, where tens of thousands of non-black allies joined 200,000 African Americans in Washington, D.C. to call for equality and economic justice. So how did white allies who marched on that day understand their stake in the civil rights movement, and what can we learn from that solidarity today? What does it mean to stand for racial justice and equality today? And what's the agenda? You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. And if you remember the March on Washington, if you were around in 1963 and old enough to be paying attention, what do you remember from that time, and how does it compare with today? Again, that number is 866-798-8255. How do you define an agenda for racial justice and equality today? You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And before the break, we were talking about how you bring a multi-ethnic coalition together to have a conversation about this, and what language is alienating, what language, you know, how can you be honest without marginalizing whole groups of people? And Claire, I think you wanted to get in on this.
Yeah, I wanted to build off what Alicia was saying, and to also bring in an idea that is a big part of how Catalyst works, which is to think not just about anti-racism, but to think about collective liberation. Mm-hmm. And what Alicia was saying about identifying that white people also have a stake in ending racism. And that's because clearly this is a system in which nobody is thriving. The important challenge for those of us who are white is to hold the reality that the term of white privilege encompasses a lot of things, and some of what it encompasses are actual real material benefits, and we have to be real about that, that white privilege is the flip side of racial oppression. Today, there was released every year from New Orleans, there comes a Katrina Payne Index, which is released by a progressive lawyer there named Bill Quigley, and one of the things that he's looking at is 8 years after Katrina, when the struggles in New Orleans are pretty off the radar for folks outside the Gulf Coast, that still you have life expectancy varying by up to 25 years predicted by race. Wow. In New Orleans. And that New Orleans is a little bit of a microcosm of what is happening around the country. So in New Orleans, you have black households are making 50% less than white households. But that's 40% nationally. This is a national problem. So when we're talking about white privilege, there are serious material benefits that are part of that. But this idea of privilege also encompasses a lot of things that are about distortion. Internalized racial superiority is a distorted way to try to understand ourselves as people, our friends and neighbors, our communities. And when Alicia is talking about rehumanizing, we also want to not let it slip out of the conversation that white people for us to be actively involved in ending racism is also an element of what we need to be doing to reclaim our own humanity, to stop participating in the system, to become more whole humans and more whole parts of multiracial, vibrant communities.
And one of the things that you do at Catalyst is run an anti-racist training for white social justice organizers. What does that look like?
So that looks like working with people who make a commitment to spend 4 months doing a deep immersion as part of a lifelong commitment to being white people who want to organize with other white folks to bring more and more of us into broader commitment and more effective action for racial justice. We do political education and provide mentoring for the participants, and they also do volunteer placements with organizations, including Power, who Alicia works with, so that people are both able to be directly contributing support to racial justice work based in working class communities of color, as well as be getting deep learning and wisdom from how grassroots racial justice work looks, and hopefully be preparing to both be able to contribute more directly themselves throughout their life, but also to expand their own circles of influence in white family and friends and communities that they're part of, so that we can keep on looking at ourselves as multipliers, because we actually need to have hundreds of thousands of white people who are committed to and active in racial justice movements, working in alliance with progressive leaders of color.
And we have an email from a listener in Berkeley who says, what do your guests feel about how Hollywood portrays race in America to the world, as in the movie Precious, what I call stereotypes on steroids, or how Hollywood portrays the history of the struggle against racism in America to the world, as in the movies The Butler or Lincoln? Rinku, you want to take that one?
Sure. I mean, Hollywood has a lot of explaining to do, I would say, and there are many, many people, I think, doing wonderful creative work in Hollywood and in film, whose voices and whose work we need to lift up. I think those two examples refer, one, to stereotypes, and the other to, actually, they all refer to stereotypes, and among those stereotypes is that of the heroic individual, the charismatic, heroic leader and individual. In stories about race, that individual often ends up being white, and I think, you know, one of the things, if you're a creative person, you're working in film, radio, any kind of storytelling, one of the things to think about is whether you're participating in a very common characterization where, you know, the white people end up being the thinking, acting people in your story, and the people of color end up being the feeling victims people, you know, that sometimes feels to filmmakers like, you know, well, here there are people of color here in the film, but if they're all in the victim role and they don't have any agency, then that's both inaccurate and disempowering. So stories have, part of the reason Hollywood is so important is that the human brain is wired for stories, not just for entertainment, but for moral lessons. You know, that is what our brain does with stories. It teaches us what we would actually do if our daughter came home wanting to marry someone of a different race, or what we would do if our son came home and said he was in love with his best friend who is a man. The stories are how we teach ourselves what is right to do. And so storytellers have an enormous responsibility and also enormous power. And the more racially conscious they are, the more able to look under the surface of their own reactions to things they are, then the more helpful stories they're going to tell.
And there's this wonderful TED Talk online by an African writer whose name is escaping me right now. And she talks about the danger of a single story, and that if you constantly tell this one story about a whole group of people over and over and over again, that's the only image that you have. And, you know, we're all multifaceted. Alicia wants to get in on this point, and then I want to go to a couple callers.
Sure. So, I mean, I just wanted to lift up, you know, this question of the power of stories and how telling a story over and over again can really not only rewrite but create history. And I'm struck by and wanting to lift up Ella Baker, who talked a lot about this, right? So when we think about the March on Washington, the first thing that people think about is Martin Luther King, right? But we also should lift up, right, Bayard Rustin, who was a queer man who was one of the principal organizers.
He was the main organizer, right?
We also want to lift up, you know, Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer and all the folks out there who, I'm not even going to say worked behind the scenes. They did work, right, to help people experience their own transformation, which got people into the streets, which got people who never thought that they could play a role to play a role and to actually create and make history. And that's part of the work that we do, right? We create history by empowering everyday people to take action. We're not waiting for the charismatic leader. Ella Baker talked about charismatic manhood, right, where we're creating these superheroes out of folks who really were expressing the dreams and the visions of millions of people. They didn't make those things up, right? You know, the I Have a Dream, right, was inspired by the sharecropper, right? Things like that create a history that is false, right, and allows us to continue to perpetuate some of the same dynamics that we're trying to break down. So I appreciated Rinku talking about the power of a single story. And again, wanting to just lift up that it's important that we acknowledge that everyday individuals create history together. It's not just about one charismatic individual.
And let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to your call. You there? Do we have David, my friends?
Can you hear me?
Hi, yeah, sorry about that, David. Go ahead.
So sorry. Hi. I'd like to challenge a little bit of the narrative here quickly, because there was an interesting study recently done by the Pew Charitable Trusts, which are well known as pretty solid center, you know, center moderate political folks who do polling on a nonpartisan basis. And they did a study that showed that the whole United States, when you polled them on average, everybody thought that there was more black racism against whites than the reverse. Mm-hmm. And then the second part of that study, which is one non-obvious, is that when they only asked blacks, blacks also thought that blacks were more prejudiced against whites than reverse. So I think that's a pretty interesting point of view, and maybe the ladies from Catalyst should think about, you know, doing this on a total racism basis, not just about white privilege, because there's a lot of black privilege and other privileges too, and we shouldn't do this from a one-way point of view. It should be much more balanced and objective.
So stick on the line, David. Let's get a response. We'll start with Claire, and then we can go to Alicia and Rinku. But stay on the line with us, and let's see what you have to say after they respond. Go ahead, Claire.
Sure.
So he's saying kind of rethink how you're framing this.
Mm-hmm. So there's a definition of racism that we find incredibly useful, which was formulated by the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond, based in New Orleans, which is that racism equals racial prejudice plus institutional power. And we find that really useful to be able to go back and look at what happened in the 80s with the development of the term reverse racism, which was a concerted and very successful effort by a number of right-wing think tanks and policy arms while neoliberalism was really taking hold, to basically create the Smoke and Mirrors Act, which removes the institutional power piece from the reality of how racism functions. So that's a really common thought, what you're bringing up, David. And what we're coming from is looking at, with the way that racism is actually structured in this country, it doesn't function without the institutional backing. It's very real and important to talk about what are different kinds of prejudices and biases that exist. Racism is also not the only system of institutional oppression that we are trying to overturn in this country. And we're also not going to get very far when we refuse to acknowledge, look at, and work to change the institutional power piece of it. So what we're talking about is a system of white racism in this country. That's where the power interests are, and that's what's got to change in order to also create more space for the work that's being done within different communities of color and indigenous communities in the U.S. to be able to stop fighting each other for crumbs and to stop being convinced that we need to be fighting for crumbs within what the Occupy movement, I think, brought some really successful language around the 99% and the 1%, and to not be fooled into flattening how we understand the 99% in this country, but to see that we're really being turned against each other and that white racism is a big piece of the power structure that enables that.
And so you're saying, you know, it's about the institutional power that a group has. David, I'm going to bring you back in just a minute, but I wanted to go to Rinku because this does get to the point that you made, Rinku, which is Americans often define racism as individual, overt, and intentional, which seems to be what you're referring to, David. But what Rinku says is modern forms of racial discrimination are really unintentional, systemic, and hidden, and have to do with institutional power. So go ahead and just respond to David, Rinku, and then I want to hear from David again.
Yep, I think Claire's done a great job of describing institutional power. I won't repeat that. I'm going to step out on a limb here and say, you know, no, there actually isn't black privilege. Everybody's got prejudices, everybody's got biases, but we do live in a context where white equals good. The recent research, speaking to the unconscious bias piece of this, recent research on what is known as implicit bias or unconscious bias, these are the ideas we have of somebody's inferiority deep in our brains that we're not aware we have. That research shows, for example, that the amygdalas, that part of your brain that controls your fight or flight instinct, that tells it to kick in or keeps calm, that part of the brain in both white and black people is most activated when the brain is presented with an image of a black person. So that means that it's not that, you know, the black person has bias against white people and the white person has bias against black people. Everybody's got bias against black people because everybody's amygdala is trained to be afraid to think white is good and black is bad. And power does, in fact, matter. You know, any kind of expression of bias certainly hurts. And if I'm with another person and I have stereotypical ideas about them, then expressing those ideas will definitely hurt. But if one of us has the power to deny the other a job or to do violence to the other and have impunity or to deny the other housing, the effect of that expression of bias is going to often last for generations. It's just going to have a objectively stronger effect than the expression of bias that doesn't have that kind of power backing it up.
And let me go back to David and get his response to what you're talking about. David, are you still with us?
Sure. Hi. I think it's incredibly sad that on the anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, that these two women are reversing 180 degrees his vision. Martin Luther King's vision, remember, was that we be judged by the content of our character, not the color of our skin. And these women have this reductionist postmodern view that says that everything is about what we look like. And I can give you so many counterexamples. Let me just pick a couple. One is that Indian Americans, those Americans who have come from India, the subcontinent, you know, thousands of miles away, many of them from impoverished conditions and so on, through mostly the gift of education, where they came and went and struggled and went to schools and became computer scientists and chemists and bankers and so on, have become one of the wealthiest, most prosperous immigrant groups in American society. They are brown. They're dark brown. Many of them almost look black, if you will, if you want to use your amygdala point of view from the brainstem. I'll take another group, Cuban Americans, who came fleeing communism in the 1950s and 60s. They are darker than us mostly. Some of them are white, some of them are brown, some of them are black, some of them are Chinese, some of them are Christian, some of them are Jewish. It doesn't matter. Those people have come and prospered in America. And yes, there was some discrimination in the past, but they get past it, they get over it. What I'm saying is that Martin Luther King's dream is what we should strive for. We should not try and put people in boxes just because you're black or white. What is Obama? He's half white, he's half black. I mean, we've got a nice cappuccino president. How lovely.
Okay, let's get a response. Alicia is wanting to speak. Thanks, David.
So I think that one of the things that is important to note here is, again, it's uncomfortable acknowledging the way that societal relations exist in this country, particularly if you're on the end of societal relations that don't have to directly experience racism. I think it's also important that we do really figure out what definition of racism we're using. Without going too much into detail, I think what's important about Martin Luther King and his legacy is that he was not colorblind. Martin Luther King was fighting for equality for Black people in this country, and his message was broad to include many other folks who were struggling for justice and continue to struggle for justice today. That includes women, that includes other communities of color, that includes immigrant communities. And we can't reduce particular groups of people to a set of experiences that we may not have experienced ourselves, but certainly that we're told, right? Well, this group came to the United States and they made it, right? And they made it by ignoring some of the very blatant and painful, and in some cases, life or death instances where they were denied humanity. So I don't want to further sully Martin Luther King's legacy, but I do want to go ahead and move towards this question of how do we understand racism? So one way that I can think of is that racism is convenience, right? One of the things that I appreciated about Rinku's article was she lifts up, right, that in restaurants, for example, that the white waiter workers, right, the white servers certainly get along and maybe, you know, have friendships with the folks of color who work in the kitchen, but that's not equity, right? That if we want to stand up for racial justice and racial equality, right, that we can go ahead and stand up to fight wage theft, which predominantly impacts immigrant workers and workers of color. We can stand up for affordable housing and domestic worker rights. We can stand for transit justice. We can stand for queer liberation. We can stand for migrant justice. Those are ways to dismantle racism in this country.
And I want to bring Rinku into this because David specifically brought up a lot of immigrant groups who migrate to this country. And interestingly, he brought up Indian, and I think he didn't bring up African,
my
but
people.
Indian, your people, and African immigrants are often the most educated and wealthy immigrants that come to this country. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of an interesting example. But one of the things that you say in your article is that as an immigrant who's spent countless hours arguing with other immigrants and refugees who refuse to acknowledge our place in a racial hierarchy and take that into account as we fight for our own freedom. So just quickly, because we're going to be running out of time, and I want to get another caller. Go ahead, Rinku.
Well, as an Indian immigrant, I can tell you that it wasn't just by dint of our own individual brilliance and hard work that we've become among the wealthiest people in the United States. We were chosen for our, at least, you know, in the early years after 1965, the early folks were chosen by the policy. We were all middle class. We had professional educations. And so what you've got is a class of Indian immigrants who came to the country with a lot of advantages right from the start, from the beginning. And my friend Vijay Prashad does wonderful writing about this in The Karma of Brown Folk. So there are ways in which we've made it. I certainly agree with David's. I can see that lots of my peers are in great situations economically and have gotten great educations in the United States. But the system helped us do that. We didn't do that by ourselves, just, you know, because we ourselves were colorblind and people didn't see our race. We did it in spite. We did it with the help of these policies. You know, Dr. King, I think his vision was that we not be judged by our race, not that nobody see our race. The vision was that we could be who we are and not have reward and punishment attached on that basis. And that is my vision, too.
And let me try and squeeze in another couple of callers. Let's go to George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Can you try and be brief because we're running out of time?
Thanks. You know, take us on a little trip. We can remember how people felt when the new president was elected in 2008. and inaugurated in the following January. And we know that a lot of people have expectations for this president. At the same time, we've seen a Congress which has locked down and refused to do business with this president. So it comes to some of us to ask, is this a Congress which is waiting for a white president? And if so, are we offended by that? And is that an example of racism on the part of this Congress? What do we have to do about it?
Or is that politics? Thank you, George. Let's go to Sharon in San Francisco, and then I'll get some response from our panelists. Hi, Sharon.
Hi,
welcome to your call.
I want to say hello and thank you so much to all the panelists whom I know for a wonderful program. My question is this. I'm going back historically to the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery except for people who've been incarcerated.
Mm.
And what I want to ask all of the participants is, as part of the definitions that you've put out around power and privilege, which I completely agree with, how do you deal with the historical and present fact that that power and that privilege is based?
Okay. Hey, Sharon, because we're running out of time and because we've got a bad line with you, I'm going to just go to the panelists and get final thoughts based on that. You know, that oftentimes we're ahistorical here in our thinking and action around this. And I'm going to limit everybody to about 30 seconds. Go ahead, Alicia.
Sure. So thanks, Sharon, for raising that and lifting up again. If we want to fight for justice, we can support the hunger strikers who are on their 52nd day. We can fight Jerry Brown, who's advocating to take money and build more prisons. We can fight that here in San Francisco with our own sheriff. So I appreciate you, Sharon, for raising that.
Claire?
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Okay. Then let's go to Rinku. We do have an email. I would love to know what and where black privilege is. I'm a 57-year-old African-American single mom, and I certainly haven't seen it. Another email says, I'd like to know just how activists plan to get through the firestorm of racist rhetoric by people like Rush Limbaugh and other racist commentators. Uh-huh. Rinku, let me give you just 15 seconds to close us out here.
I'm going to say that since 1963, we have made enormous progress in this country. It is no longer legal to explicitly segregate people by their race. The question is, are we done? And I think the very clear answer is, no, we're not done. There's a lot more to do. And I would urge your readers who are interested to hitcolorlines.com.
We're going to put a link, Rinku, we're going to put a link to all of that at yourcallradio.org. I'm so sorry to cut you off. We are out
no
of
worries.
Time. Rinku Sen is president and executive director of the Applied Research Center. We've also been joined by Elisa Garza of Power and Claire Byard of the Catalyst Project. All of that information is at yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. How concerned should we be about Fukushima? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the recent leaks from the nuclear power plant in Japan. It's been over 2 years since the Fukushima facility suffered its original damage from the earthquake and tsunami. Now, a reported 80,000 gallons of radioactive water is leaking from the plant into the ground and ocean. So what do we need to know? Could the entire Pacific be at risk? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.